Today, what I wanted to focus my remarks on is this intersection of human rights, environmental rights, and environmental protection, and oil and gas development in Turkmenistan. And sometimes those linkages may not seem obvious or apparent, but I'm hoping that through discussion today, we can kind of focus on what some of those are. And if I can master the technology here, we will get to the next slide. Oh, there we go.
Well, I think, yeah.
There we go. So I wanted to look at, I think we missed a slide. I wanted to look at four key areas today, and all this looks like a big, long thesis. It won't take us that long to get through them. One is Turkmenistan's law on hydrocarbons. Also, the involvement of international corporations, international financial institutions, so groups like the World Bank Group, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the Asian Development Banks, these are some of the IFIs that are working in Turkmenistan, and also governments and what their role is in Turkmenistan when we look at these issues, and then the resulting human rights and environmental violations and concerns that come from the intersection of these four sort of issues. The environment, the political, cultural, social environment in Turkmenistan, as many of you know, is characterized by a lack of governmental transparency and monitoring, particularly of revenues, a cult of personality, a presidential cult of personality, which places fear throughout society, and really in which the government, or the president controls everything. This is really a government that is controlled by the executive. And that fear has a lot to do with that. Bureaucrats are afraid to make decisions when the wrong decision can land them in prison, and as we'll see, that happens frequently. Endemic corruption, not unique to Turkmenistan by any stretch of the imagination, but a serious problem in the country. And then along with all of those issues, and there are others as well, of course, frequently a blind eye from the West. These issues are not treated seriously, or they are sort of put on the back burner or second to other concerns that may seem to be more pressing, given the Western, particularly Western Europe's reliance on natural resources from that part of the world. So just a bit of brief background on Turkmenistan. It's one of the most authoritarian and opaque countries in the world. It's frequently at the bottom of the lists on corruption, freedom for journalists, there's a lack of transparency, and all of the indicators of authoritarian regimes. Turkmenistan is at the bottom, and you can do a quick Google search and find that out with many of the NGOs, many of them in this city actually doing this work. It's listed as one of Freedom House's worst of the worst, and Turkmenistan has no independent media. No, civil society is forced to work underground for fear of reprisals by the government. There's no government transparency of revenues, particularly in the oil and gas sector. And according to Transparency International's 2013 Corruption Index, Turkmenistan ranked 168 out of 175 countries. So with the exception of Uzbekistan and North Korea, who ranked lower than them, all of the countries with a lower rank than Turkmenistan are currently in a state of war or civil unrest of some kind. So Turkmenistan is way down there. President Berdimuhamedov is building a cult of personality that rivals Niyazov's cult of personality, and he's building it much more quickly than Niyazov ever did. So Turkmenistan is ranked sixth in the world for natural gas reserves, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It has strong economic growth, according to the IMF, and yet 30% of the population lives below the poverty level, and that's CIA factbook data. In terms of environmental degradation, a 2012 study by Yale of environmental performance indicators placed Turkmenistan in second to last place. Only Iraq was worse. Along with its neighbors in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan has consistently low indicators for access to clean water, air pollution, and pollution from oil and gas development are both very high. So it's the intersection, again, of these three issues that are most critical for the discussion today. how environmental and human rights are routinely violated in Turkmenistan, and how this is connected to the country's oil and gas sector. So let me go next to the law on hydrocarbons, which was the first point on my other slide. So this is a picture of the Ministry of Oil and Gas. We, my friends in Turkmenistan and I joke that it looks like a lighter. And you'll notice the portrait of the president up there in the corner, so just in case you didn't know who was in charge. So oil and gas revenues make up the lion's share of Turkmenistan's official budget. But we did a report in 2011 called The Private Pocket of the President, Ferdi Mukhametov, Oil, Gas, and the Law, which shows that only 20% of the revenues from oil and gas even make it into the state budget. So 80% of those revenues are offline. The rest of the money is controlled by the State Agency for Hydrocarbon Development, which is solely managed by the president himself. He controls the management of the agency, and in order to protect the system, a series of legal reforms were amended to the hydrocarbon law after he became president, and they ensured that all of this is now legal. So there's nothing illegal about only 20% of the revenues going into the budget. So how these monies are spent is a question. We have no real answer because they're extra budgetary. And even if they existed in Turkmenistan, they wouldn't be subject to any kind of transparency laws. Despite a lack of official evidence about how the money is spent, we see enormous construction projects throughout Turkmenistan which support the idea that the monies, rather than being spent to benefit schools or hospitals or just the population in general, are going to mega projects such as the construction of the Avaza resort on the Caspian Sea that benefit the president and a small group of wealthy people. But I'll get to that in a little bit. With regard to oil and gas, the Turkmen government has managed to engage with a variety of international oil and gas companies, including major Western corporations. And again, on our website, we have information about all of the companies that are engaged in Turkmenistan. I think there's 56 of them. So they're discussing the development, potential development of off and onshore fields, both oil and gas. And these include fields in the Caspian Sea, which I'll talk about in a bit, but they're also discussing onshore fields, including Yolotan, which is a natural gas field. It's one of the world's largest fields. In order to get these resources to market, which is a task of great interest to Europe, not only to Turkmenistan, in an effort to reduce Europe's dependence on natural gas from Russia, export routes need to be developed. And there's been a lot of literature and a lot of discussion about this. One of the most well-known, of course, is to get the oil and the gas across the Caspian to Azerbaijan and then points further west. And this is where IFIs, where international financial institutions like the World Bank Group and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, come into the picture. Neither of the institutions right now is willing to provide direct financing to the oil and gas sector in Turkmenistan. In the 90s, the EBRD did finance, actually it was a Dragon Oil project in the Caspian Sea, with very poor results. And they're not willing to fund because of a lack of transparency in hydrocarbon revenues, in the government accounting, and because of the country's poor human rights record. The human rights success, and we think this is a huge human rights success in getting these institutions not to invest in Turkmenistan. It's been the result of years-long campaigning by international civil society in conjunction with activists inside Turkmenistan. So even though they're forced to work underground, there is a large group of activists who have written documents, signed documents, anonymously, they'll put their, you know, a number that they have signed this document, but have actually submitted statements to the World Bank and to the EBRD about why their financing should go a certain way or shouldn't go a certain way. So even though they can't publicly give their names and talk about what they're doing, there are people inside the country who really are paying attention, who are very concerned. And they work together with international civil society to really try and limit the involvement of the IFIs inside Turkmenistan. However, both of these institutions and the ADB, the Asian Development Bank as well, have expressed an interest in funding the development of the Turkmenbashi port, which is Turkmenistan's main export route to the west. It's the main port on the Caspian Sea. At present, Turkmen oil is transported by tanker from Turkmenbashi to the Sangachal terminal in Azerbaijan, outside of Baku, where it then joins the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline and goes west. There's a lot of dispute about how much of Turkmenistan's oil comes that way, but it definitely does. And when we were in Baku last spring and talked with folks at the Sangachal, BP staff at the Sangachal terminal, they confirmed that, in fact, Turkmenistan is sending oil that way. But many dream of adding gas to this transport to the west, and that would involve the building of the Trans-Caspian pipeline. So to develop, the development of a port is not only something that would enable increased oil and gas transportation, but it also seriously threatens a nature reserve, which is immediately to the south. So you can see in this slide here, Turkmenbashi is up at the top with the red star. This is the Turkmenbashi Gulf. All of the little triangles in the sea are offshore well sites that are managed either by, there are no Western majors who are here, so either by other international companies or by Turkmenistan state oil companies. And then down where it says Chelican Peninsula, in that inner area that comes up on the top of that, that is all the beginning of a nature reserve, and you can see it better in the different slide. But this is the area that we're talking about that's at great risk for environmental degradation. And the degradation has been going on in this part of the Caspian Sea, in this part of Turkmenistan, for at least 12 years. And we discovered this through a project that Crude Accountability did in partnership with the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Turkmen Human Rights Initiative based in Vienna in 2013. So I want to talk a little bit about the results of that research project, and part of that report was on the table for a little bit, but it's on our website as well. So in 2012 and 13, Crude Accountability and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and we have a member of the group here, conducted a study of environmental degradation along the Turkmen coast of the Caspian Sea. Because we were unable to use the methodologies that we've used in other parts of the region, where we would go in with GPS and sort of look around, see what we see, track and monitor. We obviously can't put people on the ground around the Turkmenbashi port. But we wanted to learn what we could find there. Instead of going in with people, we used satellite imagery. And we wanted to learn whether it was possible to determine the causes of persistent claims of pollution that we had been hearing from our Turkmen colleagues near the Turkmenbashi port and in the bay south of the city of Turkmenbashi. And just south of that area is the nationally protected nature reserve that I just mentioned, which is also an internationally recognized bird sanctuary. It's also a place where Caspian seals come, especially in the summer months. In the winter, they're up north near Atyrau. In the summer, they come south. And it's also a stopover on migratory bird paths for birds coming down. So with all of the talk about developing the Turkmenbashi port and the consistent absence of environmental information, which is evident if you look at any of the environmental impact assessments that the IFIs are supposedly doing, we wanted to determine what we could learn about the state of the environment. So together with AAAS, we learned that there were consistent sources of oil pollution in the region, both in the sea and in the Gulf. Between February of 2000 and December of 2012, the imagery obtained and analyzed by AAAS identified 701 suspected oil spills in the Turkmen sector of the Caspian Sea. 701 suspected spills. Of those, 147 were strong oil spill candidates in the region of the sea from Avaza, which is just north of Turkmenbashi, south to Chelican, you can see on the map, including the Turkmenbashi Bay. And of the 147 instances that were identified, over 65% of the strong candidate images were of a feature that was called the squiggle, by the AAAS researchers, which appeared approximately 55 kilometers west-northwest of the Chelican Peninsula. So in this area where you see all of these little triangles in the water. Other candidates included potential spills in the Gulf and in the Turkmenbashi Bay, but we'll get to that later. Let me just pause for a second. I know this is a really busy slide, and I apologize. But it gives you a sense of what's at risk here. What are the environmental issues in this area of the Chelican Peninsula? So where you see the little flamingos, these are areas of habitat for endangered species. The green areas mark protected areas where there are green outlines. And you can just take a look at this slide. But so the notion of setting up either a pipeline that's going to carry gas or oil across the sea, increasing the amount of tanker traffic going there, and just generally overhauling a port in this area is something that really deserves significant environmental consideration before any kind of project would be done. So the squiggle, at times, was as large as 150 square kilometers, which is approximately 60 square miles, which is the size of Washington, D.C. So imagine an oil spill the size of the city. And it changed direction and size depending on the wind and other factors. Not once over the course of the 12-year period that we researched did we find any evidence anywhere that any information had been published about this oil spill. Not in the documentation of the IFIs, not in the media, not anywhere. And interestingly, the source of the spill is located in an area of the sea that's right on the border between two oil fields. One, they're called blocks. One is managed by Petronas Oil Company and the other by Dragon Oil. And in this area, there are both active and derelict, or seemingly derelict, oil rigs. And in this picture, it's hard to see with the light. Can we maybe turn that light off just for a second so you can see that? So, thank you. So, I'm just going to get up for a second. Be a little better, professor. So, this is the source, right, of the oil spill identified. And here you can see in this image the spill, the sheen here. On the left side, you can see oil wells, some of which are active, some of which are derelict. And in our report, it gives a lot of information about this, so I won't go into a lot of it. But these are the locations, so A, B, C, and D. Here's the scale of a kilometer, so not very far. And as I mentioned, you can turn the light back on if you want. And as I mentioned, the source of this is right on the edge between these two oil fields. And we've communicated with the oil companies and with the EBRD, which financed the Dragon project. And nobody knows anything except that there were open pipes there. And part of the agreement that the EBRD made when they financed the Dragon project was that Dragon would remediate any of the old open pipes and problems that were there left over from the Soviet period. I mean, there's been development in this part of the sea since the Soviet period. So what our research indicates is that, A, Dragon did not conform with the requirements of the loan. B, nobody sort of tapped them on the shoulder and said, excuse me, but you forgot to cap off those pipes. Or even to investigate, if in fact maybe we're wrong and that's not the source of the oil spill, to even investigate and find out what's going on here. And both of those companies continue to work. They're there for 25 years, and they've been there since 2000 or 1999, and Petronas since 1996. So this is a long-term project, and it continues to go on. In addition to this spill, this was sort of the biggest, baddest thing we found. But in addition to this spill, we found evidence of potential evidence of spills in the Turkmenbashi Gulf, which directly threatened the residents of the city and the wildlife in the reserve that's just south of Turkmenbashi. And again, neither the government nor the IFIs or the oil companies themselves have talked publicly about any of the risks of any of these spills. Some of the spills may or may not be just oil. There is also a lot of toxic effluent that comes from a polypropylene plant that's right there on the edge of the sea as well. And when you look at the images, and you can look at the report, you can see that the color of the water and just the texture of the water around the areas where these potential spills is quite different. So there's very, very serious concerns about potential toxic leakage from these areas into the Gulf and into the surrounding areas. So those are some of the more outstanding human or environmental violations that we found. In the same study that we did with AAAS, we also looked at human rights violations, and we also were able to uncover direct human rights violations associated with the construction of the Avaza Resort, which was the brainchild of the former president, Niyazov, and then enthusiastically embraced by Berdy Muhammadov when he took office, and has been built and constructed. So news reports by the Turkmen Initiative for Human Rights and other sources had told the story of displaced people when the construction of Avaza began. So people have known about this, and there were two villages in particular that we looked at. But our research was able to put into perspective a human tragedy that displaced and two entire villages, and I'll show you the evidence from one, which provided the people with no compensation, took away their jobs, destroyed their homes. And from the images that follow, you can see how a modest local beachside community, as it was in 2002, was completely destroyed by 2010. So this is the village of Avaza in 2002. You can see, again, the scale. It's just, you know, a little town. This is the village in 2007. This is the village in 2010, which is no longer a village. It is now a resort, which looks like this when it's photographed from the air. So not only did they destroy the communities and displace these people and, you know, leave them without a home, a job, they also changed the landscape here. And you can see in this photograph there's a canal that's running behind the resort area. This is an area where there's not a heck of a lot of fresh water. So the construction of this canal changed the landscape, put at risk the community's access to clean water. And
it's
also...
coming from the sea? Is it coming from
the sea? No, it's actually, you know, I don't know where the water comes from in the canal.
This picture?
It looks like it is. It looks like it's connected, but we're not 100% sure. I believe it is. And then there's another village, too, called Tartar, which was also displaced, and the images of that are in our report as well. But it also, you can see, it's completely taken away access to the sea by the local community, the people who lived there before. Not only did they change it all, take them away, but this is now all blocked off. So as we noted in our Hidden in Plain Sight report, as I mentioned, the irony of this construction of the Avaza Resort is that it was built, most likely, using oil and gas revenues. Can't prove this because it's all hidden, but most likely. And just anecdotally, when we presented our Private Pocket of the President report at a meeting of the OSCE, there was a Turkmen official representative at the delegation who came up to me and said, "How can you publish this report? Don't you know that the monies from oil and gas are doing good things like building Avaza?" So we don't know for sure, but we think. So the money from oil and gas builds this resort, which is on the coast of the sea near the oil and gas offshore rigs where the water is dirty, where when the wind blows from offshore you smell the flares, and when it's blowing the other direction, you get the lovely smell of the propylene plant, the polypropylene plant from Turkmenbashi. So you're breathing these emissions, you've got the dirty sea, and it's all paid for by oil money. This is supposed to be a world-class resort. And, of course, to add insult to injury, the construction displaced the local people who lived there before. So I want to just finish up with one final piece, which talks about another campaign that we've just started recently, but also has to do, again, with this sort of misappropriation of power and revenue and really using fear and this executive authority of the president to really wreak havoc on a society, on a country, and on individual people. So there are dozens and possibly hundreds of people who have disappeared inside Turkmenistan's prisons over the last decade. Since the early 2000s, several waves of repression have shaken Turkmenistan, resulting in the disappearance into the country's prison system of countless people who've not only been tried unfairly, but have disappeared into an opaque prison system without any information provided to their relatives, their lawyers, and who've also been denied access to medical care. The largest wave of repression was in late 2002, early 2003, when dozens of people were detained following an alleged assassination attempt and coup attempt on the life of President Niyazov. Those who were allegedly involved in this coup attempt were arrested, tortured, and imprisoned from anywhere from 25 years to life in prison. Their family members, their friends, and their acquaintances in many cases were also arrested, just sort of rounded up. Many of them were also tortured, and they also, some of them, either were harassed for many years or disappeared into the prison system. And there's been no word on these people for over 12 years. So we've begun a campaign called Prove They Are Alive, which is an effort to get the Turkmen government to speak about the disappeared. Many of those who disappeared were government officials or part of the diplomatic corps, and many others were just friends or relatives of the accused. So our hope is that the international community will join in asking the Turkmen government to provide information about the disappeared. We're not asking that they be given a retrial. We're not asking even that they be classified as political prisoners. We're only asking for a response from the Turkmen government to the question, prove they are alive, or the demand, prove they are alive. So, in conclusion, I just want to return again to the original question of environmental and human rights and that connection to oil and gas development. In Turkmenistan, since its independence in 1991, the government has consistently consolidated the authority and control, creating a regime of fear and executive power. It's clear that the initial hopes for a thaw in this authoritarian rule with the election of President Berdi Muhammedov were misplaced. He's created his own cult of personality. He's failed to reform the punitive laws limiting the development of civil society and a free media. And he's even refused to distance himself from the harsh waves of repression of President Niyazov. Western oil and gas companies continue to woo the Turkmen government, hoping for lucrative deals. And European governments believe, and the United States, I should say, believe that creating a natural gas corridor from Turkmenistan across the Caspian Sea will relieve their dependence on Russia. These circumstances create an unfavorable situation for environmental protection and for human rights defenders. The absence of transparency and accountability, the willingness of Western institutions to turn a blind eye to behaviors that would be unconscionable in their home countries, and an atmosphere of fear inside the country mean that environmentalists and human rights defenders must rely on science, facts, and transparency to guide their campaigns. It's increasingly difficult for authoritarian rulers, large corporations, and governments to hide information, as our satellite imagery project has shown. And it's increasingly in the interest of government officials, including in Turkmenistan, to acknowledge that in a global community with all of its pluses and minuses, there are fewer and fewer places to hide information. Whether they recognize this is a different question. But as civil society, we must continue to push for transparency, for rule of law, and for environmental and human rights protection.